G'day humans, welcome to the safe space for dangerous ideas. Here's a dangerous idea for you. Is it okay to kill, torture, slaughter animals because you like the taste of their flesh? Don't worry, this is not an episode that is going to badger you about becoming a vegetarian or a vegan. Indeed, today's guest is quite the reverse. He's one of the most important advocates for hunting in the United States. Indeed, he's the man who got Joe Rogan interested in hunting. We were connected via our common friendship with Mr. Rogan, and once I started watching and reading Steve Rinella's work, I was struck by his depth, his humanity, his sense of humor, the kind of guy who I just instantly want to be friends with. He is the host of a television show and a podcast called Meat Eater, and he's written 10 books dealing with wildlife and hunting. And I wanted to get inside the brain of someone who is committed to an enterprise that is so alien to me as an effete in a city, latte-sipping, Chardonnay-swilling young man who wouldn't know a gun from his ass. And Steve has incredible ideas about ecology, about the natural world, about the morality of eating meat. I try to get into it with him. I try to wrestle with these ideas. And I try to understand what motivates the hunter. Steve is totally fascinating. I hope you enjoy as much as I did this conversation with the one and only Steve Rinella.
Hey, Ben.
Good, how are you?
I'm good. I briefly got to enjoy the beauty of your visage and the deep, rich timbre of your voice for about 3 minutes during a spotty connection last year.
And you
I've been
are
dreaming
you
of can... it ever since, Steve.
You came to the U.S. too, right?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Man, that was a whistle. That was a whistle stop trip. I'm glad I didn't try to squeeze it in. I'm bummed I didn't get to see you while I was in the States. But it was already like one day here, one day there, one day in the next spot. And you guys are a slight detour. No offense. I mean, I know you're the center of the universe and everything else revolves around Montana. But in terms of aviation flight schedules and commercial flights, it was going to be a haul.
Yeah, it's a little tougher. Well, sorry to miss you.
That's all right. How do you manage it? Do you have a private jet?
No, I do not. I was with some fellows the other day that were telling me about their private jet and how convenient it is. But no, I don't. I don't have one. I just fly around on the regular airplanes.
Yeah. I know. The private jet thing strikes me as one of those things where if you go there, you're just never going to go back. You're always going to do whatever has to be done financially to make your private jet work for you, because standing in the TSA line and then boarding, you know, with everybody else, for the birds, man.
Yeah, it'd be hard to go back.
Absolutely.
That's why I'm going to stay where I'm at, I think.
And just never leave. Oh, you mean never fly private?
No, I mean, I'd be like, we have humans, you know, we just get used to what we got, right? Like, I was telling my kids the other day, we're getting a new bed for my daughter, and I was telling them how for a couple years I had a couch that I turned into the wall to make like a little coffin shape. So instead of the couch opening out, I just shoved it, I flipped it and shoved it against the wall.
Right.
And I was saying, well, I was explaining to her that I went so many years without a bed and would sleep in that little coffin couch, or I would sleep on those foam shipping mats.
Yep.
You know, and then now that I have, you know, I'm not going to go, like, now I have like a nice bed. I'm not going to go back to that coffin couch, dude.
No.
So if I was to start flying around in my own aeroplane, it'd be very hard for me to go back to like 2026D on United.
yeah, I know. Absolutely. So the coffin couch bed, did this flip up against the wall, are you saying? Because
picture how you'd normally position a couch against the wall.
Yeah.
So the back of the couch is against the wall.
Yeah.
Well, imagine if you that it had big armrests on the ends. If you flipped it so the back was away from the wall, and it created like a little bucket.
It created
a little coffin.
It's that, hence the coffin. Yeah.
And I would sleep, because, you know, It just boxed you in real nice. You're not going to fall out. I would, just that little box. I would sleep in that little
secure.
Box.
You know? You'd feel secure. Mm-hmm. You'd feel like a little badger who's made his little nest. No, nothing's going to get you. The eagle would have to swoop down vertically to take you out. It could never.
There's no getting you out of there.
Yeah,
there's no getting you out of there.
When you first said that it was against the wall, I was envisaging one of those like 1970s porn star flip down beds that would come down from the wall. And then, you know, in small apartments. You're
thinking of a Murphy bed.
A Murphy bed. I think that's what it's called. And you could put it back. It's very kind of Harvey Weinstein, you know, come into my office and enjoy enjoy this wall, which also turns into a sex dungeon.
Man, my, you know, it's funny. My, you mentioned him. When I sold my first book, they bought my first book, Miramax did. And when I met my wife, that's where she worked.
Wow, really?
Yeah, she worked for Miramax and Weinstein Company, yeah. Yeah.
What was she doing, dare I ask?
She's always worked in book publishing.
Right. And Miramax had a book publishing arm?
They had a book publishing arm, yeah. I can't remember. I'm trying to remember who ran it for in the years I bought it. He was like a long publishing guy. I shouldn't say I'll never remember his name. I can't think of his name right now. But Miramax had a book publishing arm.
As soon as we stop talking, you'll remember. You can send me a text.
A lot of the titles they did were like, you know, they did a lot of titles that were kind of like Harvey's friends, man, or people that Harvey would owe favors to. Or, you know, I remember they had given a book deal to like a Page Six columnist, you know, probably to keep him friendly. It was like political figures they would publish. It was now looking at the whole thing now, one, you realize some of the decisions that were made. And then two, I think of how in the world, like, why did they ever buy my book?
What kind of favoritism was he angling for? You know, what did you have to give Bobby?
It was peers the driven snow when there was nothing to get out of me. There was nothing to you're trying to keep me from telling anyone.
That's interesting. Now I have to look into your sordid past and try to figure out if you were on Epstein's rape island and Harvey was just trying to shut you up or something.
Exactly, man. No, I'm telling you, you're not going to find. It was just a good, honest book.
He doesn't even fly private. I mean, come on. He wasn't in there with Epstein. Hasn't even been on a private jet.
Yeah, United doesn't fly to that island.
No, that's right. No hand jobs, even in first class. What do they call their new business first thing? United? Polaris. I think in Polaris you get a handy. I think that comes with the Polaris ticket. Only long haul. Only on flights of over 12 hours. You get pajamas and a hand job. Steve, was the book optioned for a movie when you sold it to Weinstein, or was it just for publishing?
No, I've had articles optioned for shows and movies and stuff, but I haven't had a book optioned, and that book was not optioned.
Okay. No. Okay.
It wouldn't have really fit that well. No, I don't know. I guess it could have, because it was strikingly similar to a book that did. It came out around the same time, too, as Julie and Julia. Do you remember that book, Julie and Julia, that wound up being like a Meryl Streep film, I think?
Sadly, I do. I've never delved into reading.
Yeah, like Meryl Streep played Julia Child. My book was right around then, and they were remarkably similar. I had never talked to the author, but my first book was... it was about there's a French chef, Escoffier, and when I'm trying to explain him to people or get people to recognize the name, if you're watching when you watch Apocalypse Now, you know, which is the greatest movie ever made, and when Chef and Captain Willard go into the jungle looking for mangoes, Chef is explaining to Captain Willard that he went to the Escoffier school. And then people know Ritz, like the Ritz hotels, right? Cesar Ritz, Escoffier was Ritz's chef in his hotels. And he invented all these dishes, but he, in 1903, he published this 5,000 recipe compendium on oat, like French oat cuisine, so high cuisine. And I did a book about finding all the shit from the book, like hunting and fishing and scavenging and collecting all the ingredients from the book, because at that time it was much more common, like wild game and all these esoteric foods were really popular, and it was the food of the royalty. So I did a book about just traveling around and finding, you know, an exploration of all these ingredients and eating habits over the time. And I found all these ingredients to cook 45 courses over 3 days. I prepared 45 courses from Escoffier's book. And so it was about kind of like changing habits, and also about American wildlife and food and things. And no one made it in any kind of movie.
I can see the
Meryl Streep. Too late if you're out there.
I'm going to option this shit. I'll play you. Meryl Streep will play the Escoffier. What does an Escoffier do? What does that mean?
Auguste, like, oh, no. He was a person.
Oh, that's a person's name, Escoffier?
Yeah, Auguste Escoffier.
Oh, okay.
And his, Auguste, you know, Auguste, whatever. Escoffier, he was a man. He was some people call him the father of haute cuisine. He took this classical French tradition of cooking and put it into words, put it into a book.
Right.
And captured, codified this like French high cuisine in this culinary guide. That was his big famous masterpiece, was the culinary guide. Like I said, it's 5,000 recipes of just sewing pigeons inside animal bladders and poaching them, and truffles, and taking a carp and stripping all the flesh off a carp and then molding it back into the shape of a carp with its head and tail, and then recreating the scales with truffles, you know, all this stuff, just outrageous, just this whole outrageous culinary tradition.
I know that I'm cooking dinner for my 6-year-old kids, Steve, the first thing they ask for is a whole carp ground up and then reshaped into a carp with truffles for scales. If it wasn't for Escoffier, they'd be eating nothing. I wouldn't be. They're like, Daddy, make us the pigeon sewed into a bladder.
Yeah, it was so wild. It was really wild and really extravagant. And it came out of this time period of just like incredible opulence. And when you're reading about that era, you know, you find that like everyone suffers from gout. You know, it's just, there was just this class of people. There was this class of people, and there were some in the U.S. and many in Europe who were just, they were gourmands. You know, I mean, like your life was comprised of social events and elaborate feasts and feasting, and who could like outdo who on feasting, and that you could somehow manage to eat a dozen oysters, you know, was sort of like an achievement, right? It wasn't just, it wasn't gross. It was an achievement, you know, go and in a day drink, you know, 2 bottles of champagne and eat what they would call a gross, you know, to eat a dozen,
have 144 oysters. Wow. You know, a half dozen oysters is romantic. A dozen is opulent. A dozen is like, I'm just a French king. Roll me into the fucking Atlantic Ocean and send me out to sea.
No, it was just an outrageous era. So anyways, that was the book that to bring this back around to our buddy Harvey, that was the book that Harvey bought.
I mean, I also love the kind of awful thing, the thing you mentioned about how back in the day, it was considered a bit working class to eat the working meat of an animal. That like the muscles, the stuff that we eat today, the flesh, that wasn't fancy. The fancy stuff was all the soft, protected, gooey bits on the inside that were hard to get to, and that there weren't very many of, the kidneys and the hearts and livers and things like that. It sort of reminds you of how arbitrary the things that we find gross is.
Are you familiar on plucked fowl, like whole plucked fowl? Are you familiar with that? What would be the tail of the bird and the base of the tail? Like the feathers are gone.
Sounds like its butthole. Are you talking about a butthole? I'm familiar with buttholes.
It includes its butthole. So it's its butthole, the base of the tail, and that little stub of tail, and it's called the Pope's nose.
Oh yeah,
I don't know why it's called.
We call it the parson's nose, but yeah, it's the best eaten bit.
Parson's nose.
Yeah.
Either way, when I was working on all this all these years ago, I found a reference of someone explaining just how rich someone was, and their way of putting it, of expressing it, was they when they buy a chicken, they only eat the parson's nose. And you're supposed to be like, good Lord, is that man wealthy?
Oh, fuck, that's funny. Oh, my goodness. How many?
Like, if someone's cutting up a chicken now, they're like, I can tell you what part's going in the garbage.
No, I'm eating the parson's nose. I love the parson's nose. But the idea that you would have to murder like 25 living creatures just because you're so particular, you'll only eat the little knobby bit above its butthole and throw the rest away. Give it to the cat. That's hilarious. Yeah. It's wild, isn't it? And then you go to different parts of the world and different people are prizing different things and different kinds of animals. And like, have you ever eaten dog?
Yeah, I have. I have. Years ago, I used to write for Outside Magazine quite a bit. That was kind of my first, when I got out of graduate school, my first kind of like real writer thing to happen to me was I started working for and was on the masthead at Outside. And I was never under contract, but I was doing a lot of work for Outside. And it was kind of the glory days of magazine writing. It seems so distant now, but you'd go and you might go and do a feature and blow $9,000-$10,000 on travel, you know. It's just a different time to be a magazine writer. But I don't remember how I got onto the idea or how I got on the subject, but I went to Vietnam for the Lunar New Year celebrations, for the Tet celebrations.
They'll find you your dog meat over in Vietnam. Yeah.
Yeah. And it was, as I learned and explained in my story, it's a very auspicious time of year. To eat dog meat, particularly in the north, and it was regarded as there's something I kind of struggle with in explaining, because it was described to me and regarded as a very hot food, and I laughed about that because the feeling I would get a hot feeling, like I would get like a guilt, like a hot sweaty guilt feeling eating it, but they meant hot like it was It had the ability to change luck. It had the ability to correct your course in life. Now, that perception wasn't the same in Saigon or Ho Chi Minh City, just in the south of the country. It was much more, you could kind of get away with eating it year round in certain places. But in the north, in Hanoi, around the days of the New Year celebration, these Thit Cho, these like dog meat places would just spring up. I had a bunch of dog meat right on the shoreline of that lake where they fished John McCain out of the lake after he got shot down. And they would serve the paws and all manner of things. I had a guy explain to me, for instance, he said he couldn't have children, okay? Like he and his wife couldn't get pregnant. And to turn the tide, he went out and ate dog meat on the Lunar New Year, on New Year's. And then got his wife pregnant. So here he was in a situation where he explained to me, he doesn't eat it now. So that was like, man, you probably started eating all kind of dog meat then. And he's like, well, no.
So I don't want to have 300 children.
Well, no, he didn't want to initiate that course correction. Like, he didn't want to do another thing that could alter his luck. Like, he'd landed right in the right spot. I mean, other people had different relationships with it, but just to give you a sense, man, and this is quite a while ago that I did this piece, but I ate it for a week. And my wife was my girlfriend back then, but she was with me some of that time, and she went out and ate it. And we ate it all manner of ways, man, like all manner of ways. And another really kind of stunning thing that happened out of that was I had hired a translator, and he was a veteran of what he called the American War. And had actually been injured during the American War. And we spent a lot of time talking about that. And he lived right in the old part of Hanoi. And when you opened his door, man, like there was about 6 inches of space and you were on what seemed to be the busiest street in Hanoi. I mean, 1,000 mopeds per minute, right? Pouring by. And he had a dog. He had a dog in a little kennel, like a travel box. For whatever reason, I said to him something like, well, how do you go for a walk? Because it was so treacherous just to be out, to step out of his door. I couldn't picture doing it with a dog. Is the only reason that I would have asked him how you take your dog for a walk. And he looked at me like he didn't know what I was talking about. And he was my translator, so he was fluent. And I'm like, well, how do you, when you go to walk your dog, where do you go? And in our conversation, I realized that he had brought that dog home in that box, and that dog had never been out of that box.
Yeah.
And he explained to me, I don't eat dog. I have a pet dog. And he kept the dog like a bird. It was like he kept the dog like a bird in a cage. And America, I don't know what goes on in your neck of the woods there. America wasn't half as crazy about dogs 20 years ago. It wouldn't have been 20 years ago. They weren't half as crazy about dogs 17 years ago when I had this experience as they are now. Like, dogs have become like honorary American citizens since then. But at that time, 17 years ago, when dogs were kind of just still like dogs, I was blown away by it. And then you realize, like, that's one of the, you know, of course, one of the beauties of travel. Is you realize all the different angles one can take on being alive. And it was just different, man.
No, totally. Also, the idea that an animal would need to, like, have a human walk it. You know, like, I mean, even if you, you know, it's an animal.
Oh, you're right.
Like, even if you accepted the premise that the dog shouldn't be in a box, you would just let it out of the box and the dog would go and fuck off and, you know, go for a walk or a run or whatever the fuck it wants to do. It doesn't need a human being working for the dog. You're right about the elevation of canines in our, there will be a time when there will be a Kardashian who is president. And the vice president will be a chihuahua. The vice president will be a chihuahua in a fucking handbag, Steve. Yeah,
I was trying to explain to my kids the other day, we have a dog. My kids have a dog. They got a dog from the dog pound. And we got one of those buried wires that keeps the dog from running away.
I don't know what that is. What is that?
Oh, like you get them this little electric collar that'll bing and it'll give them a very slight zap.
Talking about how infatuated we are with dogs. You're spending thousands of dollars electrified underground collar system.
Look no further than my home. Okay. But I was trying to explain to my kids, I was like, when I had a dog, when a dog got up in the morning, it left and it ran around with a pack of dogs from around. And at night you'd go out and yell its name for 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And it would eventually come in, and then in the morning get up, and him and his buddies would take off again. And that was what a dog did. Yeah. And I'm like, that wasn't a bad life for a dog. No.
And then one day the dog would not come back when you called, and that was the end of Rover. That was the end of your relationship with Fido.
Yeah, man. I've got an indoor cat. We got a cat last year for my kids who are 6-year-old twins, and you know, they wanted a kitten. And it's, I don't know what it's like in the States, but here there's a big controversy over allowing cats out because cats are not native to Australia. We have a lot of vulnerable native critters. You know,
yeah,
we have
got
little,
a cat problem.
We have a huge feral cat problem. But even setting aside the feral cats, we have a ton of native birds who get killed by domestic cats. We have a huge number of tiny, hopping, vulnerable, gray, furry, cute little marsupial things bouncing around that get devoured by domestic cats. So there's a big movement that you're supposed to keep your cat inside. But man, I don't know. I'm like 6 months
no,
in.
No, don't tell me you let the
in.
Cat out.
No, I haven't yet. But I'm like, what kind of a life is it for the cat?
Yeah. I follow wildlife politics. And so of your native land there, the only thing when I'm reading about your country, I'm just reading about your wildlife politics. And I just love wildlife politics. And so I read about your kangaroo issues. I read about your house cat issues. I read about your koalas all having STDs. Like, yeah.
The koalas do have STDs. Yeah, it's true. They have, is it syphilis or chlamydia that's killing them all?
Yeah, I think everyone's like, got a chlamydia problem.
Everyone's like, save the koalas, save the koalas. I'm like, we're trying. Can they stop being so filthy, the dirty little whores? Just spreading their own venereal diseases. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, what do you think? Should I let my cat out or should I leave it inside?
I can't remember in the U.S., I can't remember what the estimate is, but house cats, so feral or not, you know, just house cats out on the landscape, pets that are out during the day or feral kill over 1 billion songbirds a year here. Right? And so, as much as people like to point fingers about wildlife issues, I mean, cat propagators and cat owners have a lot of blood on their hands when it comes to Tweety birds. There's a cat that runs around. I'm actually friends with the people that own it. There's a cat that runs around our neighborhood without a little bell on it. And I always think about catching it and putting a bell on it. And then, you know, I wouldn't like shoot their cat, but
someone
I don't think
told me that
if you're going to let that cat out, just get it, hang a bell on him.
Someone told me the bells don't do shit.
No, I have a very hard time believing that.
You reckon they work?
Oh, hell yeah. I mean, maybe not 100% of the time, but I mean, you saddle that thing with making all that racket, it's going to kind of blow his whole program.
That's true. It's hard to be stealth. Fuck. Thought I was trying to sneak up on this bird. Okay, I'll keep the damn thing inside. But I mean, you know, this sort of brings us to the bigger issue of like, why exactly do I need to care about the songbirds when I eat meat with impunity and dominate my environment in myriad other ways that I should probably mitigate before I care about the one or two songbirds that my cat might catch over the course of its lifetime?
I would answer that by talking about preserving endemism and biodiversity. And there's a, you know, endemism is like an endemic species is something found in one place, right? Like its distribution is limited to a specific area, right? We have lost extinction is forever, right? Well, you could say that, but at a time in the future, that might not be the case. But let's say for now and for the last collection of millennia, extinction is forever. And we have lost dozens of species of ground nesting birds to mongooses, cats, rats, basically to non-native creatures that have been brought to and introduced onto landscapes where their prey base hasn't adapted to their presence. So you have ground nesting birds, and for the history of time, they've developed certain strategies to reproduce successfully. And then you throw something into the mix that just was never accounted for, never adapted with, and it devastates it. How someone might think that a person that eats deer meat from a species of animal that is a IUC, like a International Conservation Union species of least concern, meaning a very abundant, very prolific species that occupies all of its historic range, and is very carefully managed, how eating that deer could somehow make it that you are not free to have an opinion about saving ground nesting birds from extinction. The fact that some people think that those are like irreconcilable activities or perspectives is to me, it's crazy. Right. I eat deer and I care about biodiversity a tremendous amount. Maybe I care about biodiversity because I eat a lot of deer meat.
Yeah. I think that's where someone like you gets your credibility from when you talk about sustainability. And second to you would be someone who I think is a hardcore vegan who thinks about these things very deeply and is taking a principled and extreme position. And I think the people with the least credibility to talk about environmental issues, sustainability, and biodiversity are people who, like, much like a friend of mine who I was talking to the other day, said, like, you know, I just want to be able to go to the supermarket and I want my chicken breasts to look clean and glowing and shiny in the styrofoam with cling film over them. I don't want to think about it. I don't want to pay more for the organic shit. I don't give a fuck. Like, you know, just I want it to be an ingredient.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's sort of that's the source of all of the problems in the natural world.
It's very normal, though. You know, it's a normal opinion. My wife doesn't hunt. She eats more non-game than, or sorry, my wife doesn't hunt. She eats more wild game than a lot of the hunters I know. She's quite comfortable eating deer meat without having killed a deer. You know, and in a way I've expressed this over the years would be, society has allowed humans to become very specialized. But if you go back some number of years, if you go back before the agricultural revolution, you'd find that humans weren't as specialized. Most humans weren't as specialized, meaning you would conduct a lot of the, you and your family would be responsible for many of the things you needed to stay alive, meaning you might produce your own fabrics, okay, from animal hides, from plant fibers. You might sew those fabrics. You might produce your own cookware. You'd secure your own food. You'd deal with your own waste. You'd construct your own home. You'd construct your own bed. You'd deliver your own children. You'd administer your own healthcare, right? And then we eventually got to where we could all become great specialists. And then we would be that you kind of do a thing, you know, you do a thing. And you farm out all of your activities. So now I don't, for instance, like I don't process my family's raw sewage. I pay some money and that's handled elsewhere. When we have car problems, if it's anything major, we farm that out to somebody. We don't do it. So I am guilty of handing things over to other people because I don't want to deal with certain things that I find to be not fun. Like you might say, it's like it'd be like gross to process your own sewage, so you don't. They're better at
it. I like that your idea of a self-sustaining hunter-gatherer society is that there was such a thing as processing your sewage. I believe processing your sewage was you threw a bucket of sewage towards your neighbor so that it wasn't around you.
However you deal with it. The Bible has instructions about how you should deal with it. But
And also administering your own health care. You're like, we don't administer our own health care anymore. Well, yeah, administering your own health care used to be you would look at the wound and you'd go,
ain't good.
I think you're fucked.
But of all this stuff, like of all these things that we hand out to other people, the one that I don't like to hand out, there's one that I like to hang on to is I like to hang on to getting my own food. Like that one's really important to me that I hold on to. But point being, what I'm trying to get at is for me to then blame someone who's not out killing their own chicken, you know, I'm like, who am I to cast judgment on them? There's all kinds of things I don't do. I didn't build my own house. So the fact that they're like, for me to like act like I'm going to be critical of someone who buys chickens down at the grocery store, it's like, I'm not, you know, I can't sit here and look you in the eye and tell you that I've personally gone and secured every comfort I have in my life. So like I said, I didn't make my house.
No,
I farmed that out to somebody else.
I mean, you're being more generous than I would, because if there was a system of home building that we knew was catastrophic to the lived experience of hundreds of billions of sentient creatures and was devastating for the planet's environment, and if you were choosing to save a little bit of money by getting the cheapest, you know, type of plywood or something for your house instead of paying 10 to 20% more to build a house that was sustainable, and you were justifying that by being like, you know what, I just like not having to think about it, I'd be like, well, you probably should. Yeah, you probably should think about it.
Yeah, you've taken the metaphor. You've taken our metaphor very deep. You're right. That's a good point. I was going to get at something. I wish I could remember where I was getting at something broader with all that. But no, you're right. You could make an adjustment.
Yeah, I'm not saying everybody has to be Steve Ranella, but I think everybody has to incorporate a worldview that places them in a position of some kind of moral responsibility in the network of living things. If you believe that it's wrong to saw the leg off a dog while it's alive, then you believe that animals are capable of feeling pain and probably having some kind of aspirations. And if you think that it's bad to, you know, rip baby pigs away from a mother pig while she's squealing and screaming about it, then you're implying that the pig has an internal life that's worth giving a shit about. And if that's the case, then you should have a consideration that's more than just the number of cents of pennies that you pay for a pound of the flesh of an animal when you're doing your shopping. And we should probably all collectively have tighter rules about the treatment of animals. I mean, even just look at the hypocrisy between the types of animals. You know, you mentioned dog. I've eaten dog in Vietnam, didn't really care for it. I've eaten crazy animals, partly because I think it's sort of almost my moral duty. I almost felt like I'd be hypocritical not to eat dog if I was going to eat pig. It's sort of arbitrary. Like, why is one good and one bad? Just because I happen to be born into a Western country in the 21st century?
That's true.
Does that make? If it was in a different time and place, we'd have different norms about animals, which is not to say that there isn't like a hierarchy of animal sentience and suffering that I would take into consideration. I'd be much more comfortable eating insects than I would, or, you know, prawns and crustaceans than I would a chimpanzee. But when you're talking about relatively comparable, like, psychological capabilities, like a pig and a dog, then it kind of just falls down to arbitrary choice, doesn't it? And I feel like we should either be all in or out.
You know where I'm gonna frame this in a different metaphor, since we're speaking of metaphors, and I'm gonna try to capture a little bit of how I think on this issue. And you mentioned earlier of you know, the morals of a vegan, a practicing vegan being you know, like there's a clarity there, right? There's like an unassailable clarity and mission there. A way I've come to think about animal welfare, And I'm speaking in terms of the animals that I engage with, okay? The animals that influence my life, the species that I engage with, the species that I try to help preserve, the species I utilize for personal use. I think of them as one might consider, and let's say an apple tree, okay? Where I imagine that the apple tree is the environment and habitat, okay? And if that apple tree is cared for and fertilized, that thing is going to produce apples. And once those apples are done and they've ripened and they're close to falling from the tree, or they've already fallen from the tree, no matter what you do to that apple, that's not damaging that tree. It'll become a sort of perpetual motion machine. So I, with my worldview, with my mind frame, I remain very concerned about the tree. An animal rights perspective or a vegan perspective would probably be more like this. It would be that they put a real value on the well-being of the apple, right? And I think that they might look at me and think that I have a I'm incapable of assigning a unique identity to those apples. I just view them as the product of something, and I don't afford them individuality. And I would look and say, man, you're so worried about the apple that you're just not paying attention to the tree. There's always going to be apples. If you take care of the tree, the apples don't matter. And they'd say, man, I think each and every one of those apples matters. And if the tree quit producing apples, that's okay. Because then it's not making these apples that would need to suffer when you yank them off the tree. And it's just like, it's in some way, you know, I think in some way these like perspectives on it are incompatible.
Yeah, I mean, I'm with you up until the final move, which I think only the most extreme vegans make, which would be it wouldn't matter if the apple tree dried up as long as there was no suffering of the apples. I mean, that analogy would be to say that it doesn't really matter if an ecosystem collapses as long as it's no longer producing animals.
Well, the reason I'm saying that is because I'm
like, there aren't very many. That would be an extreme vegan position.
No,
and I think most of them would say you want the ecosystem to be healthy and you also want the apples. Okay.
I'm not seeing that though. I get what you're saying. And I don't think that, and I don't encounter animal rights activists who say they don't care if the tree stops producing. But when I look at where their focus is, they're fixated on the apples, and it hasn't occurred to them to pay that much attention to the tree, because you can have certain groups and certain systems in place that are meant to support the tree, but they will damage those systems, neglect those systems, deny that system.
Can you give me an example of such a system?
Okay, I will. In the United States, I know we have this little problem of that we're in distinct places with distinct conservation histories and distinct management.
That's all right. Half my audience is in America.
Okay. In the United States, all 50 states have what we call state fish and game agencies. Okay, they're administered in different ways, but the way they basically work is you have a state agency that has a commission or a sort of board of directors. There's a head of the agency, and these agencies are in charge of all fish and wildlife. Almost universally, they're in charge of fish and wildlife within the state. In some cases, those same agencies might have oversight over certain marine resources. They might have oversight over certain chunks of land and things, but just the one safe way of putting it is they're in charge of fish and wildlife up until the point that fish and wildlife, that a species would become so degraded that it would warrant federal protections. And then we have a layer of federal oversight through this thing, the Endangered Species Act. We have this layer of federal oversight where the feds can come in, the federal government could come in and start dictating to the states about how they're going to manage some resource. But up until that point, the vast majority of all the fish and wildlife is administered by the state. Where state fish and game agencies get their funding, the state fish and game agencies, the one true area they get their funding is from sales of licenses, tags, and stamps. They're funded through the purchasing of fishing licenses, hunting licenses, and they're also funded through a grant program through this very convoluted process by which sales of sporting goods, particularly firearms and ammunition, have a 13% excise tax. Every time a guy buys a gun, if you bought a gun for $100, 13 of those dollars goes into this fund, which pays for wildlife habitat and the work of the state agencies who have teams of biologists. So they deal with disease outbreaks, they deal with access issues, they deal with monitoring, all this stuff. An animal, when I talk about an animal rights person, maybe not explicitly saying that they don't care about the tree, here is this support mechanism. If we have this tree metaphor, the arborist, the person, the gardener, is a state fish and game agency, which is by and large funded by hunters and anglers and gun owners. They're paying the gardener's salary. But then you go and say, I care a lot about the apples, and what I'd like to do is I'd like to see the gardener's funding cut off because I know where he gets his money. He gets his money from these bloodthirsty hellbillies who want to eat those apples. This metaphor has gone far enough.
You're like, I'm out. I set it up for you, Zeps. I've teed it right up. If you're not following me, I'm done.
I'm going to abandon the metaphor and just move on to talking about it more specifically.
Yeah, but that's what I mean.
What I mean when I say that.
But I gave you a like 30,000 foot moral question, right, about the culpability of people who live in an industrialized 21st century economy that is highly reliant on factory farming for getting our food and industrialized farming. And you've taken it to a frankly sort of narrow logistical question about the political aspirations of, you know, of anti-hunting lobbies in the state of Delaware. You know, if you talk to Peter Singer, or, you know, one of the founders of the animal rights and animal liberation movement, you know, who is, then what he's banging on about is not we need to defund, you know, provincial gaming licensing bodies in provinces and states.
No,
he's saying the superstructure of industrialized food, in which the only consideration basically is corporate profit and the reduction of cost to the end consumer, has to end because it's a calamity for all of the apples. Now, your idea about the apple tree being more important than the apple, he may concede. He may actually say, yeah, thriving bio, you know, a thriving ecosystem is a good in itself as well. And yet for him, the talk about the tree with no focus on the apples would sound like you're needlessly degrading or ignoring the ability of the apples to have experiences and to feel pain. Like, apple is a nice analogy because we know that apples are pretty inert and we bite into them, you know, without feeling bad about ourselves. But if it came to light that various different types of fruit had various capacities for experiencing pain, hardship, hopes, aspirations, and suffering, then wouldn't your analogy about the tree have to be modified to incorporate concerns about the apples?
No, because here's where I'm incriminating myself a bit.
I don't give a shit about them apples.
No, I do, because I would never think, if my kid was picking an apple, I would never say, man, don't just slowly twist the apple until it falls. Just pluck the thing off. why are you making the apple sweat it so bad?
Right.
So there is a, I'm interested in humane, not interested in, I strive for humane slaughter and responsible use. So yeah, the, it's not like all, like all analogies, it's imperfect, but I do want to stay. I one thing I'm not going to walk back is I am almost wholly focused. I'm almost wholly focused on the tree. There are considerations I have. There are considerations I have about, there are considerations I have about animal welfare. But when I get a deer, when we get a deer, when I get a deer, I'm happy that I got a deer. I'm just happy that I got it. Now, if I get, if I hit a deer with my bow, I had a deer last year I hit with my bow, and that deer went, I hit it and it hit a little far back. I caught one lung down low, and that deer went, I'll put it in the meters for you, 1,200 meters, which I think is 1,200 yards, so I can say that. Went 1,200, you know, roughly.
Nobody knows maybe what like, a fucking
maybe
yard
off
is,
by so one
yes,
or two.
I'll tell you.
Went 1,200, you know, the deer went 1,200 yards before it collapsed, okay? A part of me is like, man, I fucked up. If I'd have caught both of its lungs up higher, it wouldn't have gone 40 yards. It would have been dead like within seconds, but it wasn't. It took quite some time to go 1,200 yards. And so I fucked up, but still I was happy that I got it. So,
yeah, I mean, let me ask it this way.
Does I wasn't the, tore up.
Yeah. I mean, I think we can tell that there's an instinct that the apple, the type of apple must matter, because you would probably behave differently if instead of hunting deer, you were just hunting, I don't know, centipedes or something like that. Mm-hmm. And maybe sure. You would act differently. Would you act differently if the ecological scenario was exactly the same, but instead of you living in an ecosystem where it was deer, it was chimps?
Well, now I got to tell you that I've ate monkey too, but it was served to me in South America. Didn't like that either. Let me give you, I'm going to arm you. I'm going to arm you here with a great example. If the next time you're talking to an American, if you have this discussion again, I'm going to tee you up for a good thing to poke at him about. We have, and I think you do as well in Australia, we have a problem with feral pigs. Okay. So it's, the pigs are Sus scrofa is the Linnaean name for pigs. And if you went back prior to, Europeans arriving in the New World, so Europeans arriving in North and South America, this species of pig, Sus scrofa, I mean, they were from Siberia to North Africa. They were everywhere, but they weren't in the Western Hemisphere. And Europeans brought them and cut them loose in the Western Hemisphere, and they wreak ecological havoc. They are an economic problem because they cause a lot of crop damage and agricultural damage. They're a water quality problem because they muddy up a lot of water. They're a native species problem because they devour and destroy native plants. They devour and destroy eggs from imperiled bird species. They're just a problem, okay? People like to hunt them. I hunt for them. I eat them, but they're regarded as a problem. And an interesting thing that I've found is there are guys that would, when hunting deer, there are guys that would never think of just hitting the deer in the back leg if that's all you could see. Meaning you see a deer in the woods and you can just see its back leg and you know, oh man, I could hit it in the back leg and it ain't going to go anywhere. I'll get it. They would never in a million years do that. Because why would you make a deer suffer? It would be so frowned upon. You would be like excommunicated from your group of hunters if you deliberately shot the back deer, back leg out of a deer. Someone hunting pigs, they're not going to think a thing about that. They're not going to think a thing about shooting a ton of pigs and leaving them laying. They wouldn't think a thing about shooting a pregnant sow. They wouldn't think a thing about shooting a sow with a bunch of piglets. Why? Because they're such an ecological, they cause so much ecological damage. But what in the world does that have to do with that individual pig's suffering? That pig can't, to think that you could imagine that that pig could comprehend that it's a non-native causing ecological harm. Therefore, he'd be like, man, they blew my back leg out while I have piglets trying to nurse from me, but I sure had it coming because DeSoto brought my forefathers here in the early 1500s.
Yeah.
But yeah, you can make the leap.
I had the reverse conversation with someone who was trying to give me shit for having eaten dog. And this guy was saying, how could you eat dog? And I said, well, what's the difference between eating a dog and eating pig? He said, dogs have been by our side for thousands of years. And I was like, yeah, but not the dog I ate.
Yeah.
Not the dog I ate hasn't been by our side for thousands of years. He doesn't know shit. And, you know, the pig, why are you punishing the pig? Because the pig's forefathers weren't around a campfire with, like, cavemen who were ancestors of yours hundreds of thousands of years ago. Doesn't matter to the individual sentience of the creature. But, I mean, that's a nice story. Yeah, but you're kind of dodging, Steve, the question of, like, if you were in an environment in which in which chimps had the same.
I thought I just answered this. You said I dodged it? Oh, sorry. Say it again, because I just know I dodged it.
So, you know, if you were in an environment in which chimpanzees occupied the same position in the ecosystem as deer do, then would you hunt chimps the same way that you hunt deer?
I don't want you to accuse me of dodging this question, but I'm going to tell you something. Yesterday I was talking to you. No, I'm going to get to it. Yesterday I was talking to a kid. Okay. I was talking to a kid yesterday. Not a kid. He's like out of college. A young man. And we were talking about cultural mores around the world. And I said, when you're young, you think you're the way you are because you're you. The older you get and the more you travel around, you start to realize how much you're the way you are because of where you're from and who you grew up around. But you like to think that your morality, your do's and don'ts are some individual creation. You know, you're like created, you're a product of your environment. I earlier talked about going out in Bolivia with some Amerindians, some dudes that were chamane, and they were out hunting monkeys. Okay. They love red howler monkeys. If I had moved in that day with those hunters, and I admired those hunters, like, man, it had to change my life hanging out with those hunters. That's what I would have become, you know? And if it's just, I was born of a place where we just like didn't deal with primates like that. But knowing that I'm a hunter, I would probably, it's safe to say that I would largely adopt probably adopt the life ways of the hunters that I was around. So you don't even have to go to some crazy end of things to say that if I went to live with the chamane and moved in with the chamane, which wouldn't be half bad. Yeah, man, we'd eat a lot of cerube catfish and we'd probably hunt a lot of monkeys.
I think there are two. Yeah, so there are two questions.
Dodge or is that not a dodge?
A little bit, but I'll explain why. I think I've given you two questions in one. So let me tease the two questions apart. Mm-hmm. One question, which you've just answered, is about how culturally contingent our behavior is, right? If if I'd grown
it's
up
so
in the
obvious,
South,
but people forget that it's true.
Exactly. If I'd grown up in the South of in the deep South of the United States, I would have a different relationship to guns than I do growing up in Australia. If I, you know, if we lived in a place where dog was eaten, we would be eating dog. If I grew up in Afghanistan under the Taliban, then maybe I would be doing all kinds of things that I regard as being beyond the pale, having grown up where I do. That's a different question from whether or not I'm in a position to say that I would be wrong if I were a jihadist. Like, I can recognize the psychological reality of the fact that if I were raised as a jihadist, I would be a jihadist. Mm. But I can. There's a second question, which is, do I think it's just as good to be a jihadist as it is to be a liberal Democrat? And I would say, on the second point, no. So you answered the first point about, yeah, of course, if you were raised in a society where it's okay to kill primates, then you would kill primates. But on the ethical question, I mean, this only occurs to me because of your apple tree. Yeah, your apple tree analogy. Like, do we, in other words, do we care at all about the interests of the apples? And if you turned up the volume on the apple's capacity for sort of thought,
yep,
would it
matter? Ready to answer it. I don't think that I'm better than hunters from the Congo or hunters from South America who eat monkeys. I don't think that they are wrong. These ancestral hunters producing traditional life ways, I don't think are wrong to hunt monkeys of any sort. I don't know how common it is. I think that it would become wrong at the point, say in the case of gorillas, a host of other things, it would become wrong. It would become morally wrong, categorically wrong, at a point where they were imperiling the species. But up until the point where they're not imperiling the species, I don't think they're wrong.
Right. Why are humans exempt from this analogy, by the way?
Like, why is it bad for us to eat each other?
Yeah, like, I mean, because if we're going up the sort of... I'm like the most interviewer in the world. If we're going from the... if we're going up the hierarchy of consciousness, right, from your, mm-hmm. from your caterpillar to your eating your sewer rats to eating your dog to eating your deer to eating your chimp, and if you're... your kind of lodestar, your shining light on the hill is the tree, right? Is the wellness of the tree. And the apples are always subservient to the tree. Mm-hmm. Then, you know, what if the ecosystem would be better if there were fewer individual human beings? Like, why do we get... I assume that you know what I mean? Like, why do we get special license to be our special apples as much as we want? Because... if I were particularly stupid, I could use your analogy to justify genocide, right? I mean, it's a bit like, you know, the Nazis loved the tree of life and they wanted their 1,000-year Reich. Who gives a shit about the individual apples? You know, you got to break a few eggs to get to a brighter future. You know, this is what Stalin thought about human lives. Why are animal lives different?
I acknowledged earlier the imperfection of the analogy, and I also tried to leave the analogy behind. The old apple tree analogy. But yeah, it's a great question.
It's gonna haunt
it's so far
days,
you know, to take this question of in service of the apple tree, would someone go out and decide to start in service of the apple tree, should someone go out and justify fratricide? Let's dig in on that for a minute. More than half of your listeners will know what I'm talking about when I mentioned Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber. Here was a person who, in service of the apple tree, was willing to start whittling away at his brethren. I mean, that was his he was an environmentalist who'd been radicalized as a young man and got to the point where we were going to wage war on humans He was going to wage war on humans to save the environment, to save the apple tree. But, you know, at this point, it's like I have never been in a situation where I sat around like thinking about whether I should start eliminating humans. And
we're starting right now, Steve.
Well, to get to this right part now. On the food thing, I think that it's like, if you take hunter-gatherer cultures that live in, you take hunter-gatherer cultures that live around primates, you just find that not always, but it's quite common for hunter-gatherer cultures that live around primates to prey on primates. Cannibalism is just such a wild exception. You know, I mean, you could kind of go and you could make like a pretty short list of cultures that practice cannibalism. And the minute you pull out religious factors around immortality and achieving and consuming someone's aura and all this spiritual stuff, the list gets even smaller, meaning like people who are out there practicing cannibalism for sustenance. It's just so, I mean, it's just, it's so limited that my mind never goes there.
For you, the existence of a culture that's practicing the practice is also morally relevant.
Man, I'm trying to think of it. I'm reading a book right now. I'm reading Hampton Sides' new book, The Wide, Wide World. And it's about Captain Cook's third voyage, where he leaves, you know, he leaves England and goes down around Cape Horn and goes to Tasmania, goes along, visits New Zealand, then goes along Australia, goes to the Hawaiian Islands, goes to Alaska, comes back to the Hawaiian Islands, and then gets cut up and eaten a bit, maybe. But in their journals, and him and his shipmates' journals, they encounter, it's weird because they run into multiple cases of cannibalism. They run into cannibalism in New Zealand. They run into some cannibalism in Hawaii and elsewhere. And in reading it, like normally when I'm reading that book and they're hunting walruses, I'm like, man, that's so cool. You know, the natives are hunting porpoises, and I think, man, that's so cool. And he gets to Alaska and they're hunting whales, and I think, man, that's so cool. And they're catching big halibut. But when I get to the parts about eating folks, there's no part of me that's like, man, that's so cool.
I'm off the train.
It's just there's some deep deal. And yeah, like there's some deep deal where.
Right. But that's
we give our species a pass, but it's not universal. Like, you know, have you ever heard of Kodiak Island in the Aleutians in Alaska? When they do, like, when you look at food surveys, a predominant food source of male brown bears on Kodiak Island is brown bears. It's one of the main things they eat. In the Rocky Mountains, the greatest risk a wolf has is it'll die from a wolf. The number one killer of wolves is wolves. So there are cases around where that's not extended. Our sense of like, man, I got my limits. I'll eat a chimpanzee. I'll eat a red howler monkey. I'll eat a dog. I'll eat a horse. I ain't eating folks. It's like, there are exceptions, but it's just not even something.
Well,
I mean, of course,
a wolf doesn't give a shit. I mean, and of course, a bear doesn't give a shit, right? But I mean, I think the reason why.
And a chimp will eat a monkey.
You're right, but the reason why we would say that it's wrong to eat a person, unless we're using a religious... I love where this conversation has gone. The reason why we would say it's wrong is not just because we are members of that species. I'd like to ground it in something more objective than that. I mean, I think humans have a... I mean, I might include chimps in this as well, and maybe dolphins or something. I don't know. I'm not a, you know, environmental bioneurologist.
You're not an animal scientist.
I'm no animal scientist, folks. But the capacity of a creature to contemplate its own demise, plan for the future, you know, have complicated social arrangements with large networks of friends and colleagues to, aspire to anything other than just sort of sniffing around in the dirt and trying to find mushrooms. Mm. I think that gives us a reason why each apple, to go back to that analogy, is worthy of consideration in addition to the apple tree. And in extremis, that would fall apart. Like, I don't think there's anything wrong. If I was in the plane crash in the Andes, I'd rather be one of the guys who's gnawing on someone else's dead leg than one of the guys who's dying in the snow. Right. Oh, but yeah, I wouldn't want to make a habit of it.
No. In the times when I've been curious about cannibalism, I've always thought that a good way out of it would be that you knew someone and they like lost an appendage in a car crash or something, and you're buddies with them, and you guys like partook.
You're like, may I have your blessing?
Then he's like, you're not hurting anybody. You're not hurting anybody. They weren't going to do anything with it anyway. You can satisfy
your
curiosity.
Why does it have to be your buddy's leg, Steve? Make it your leg. You lose a leg. You're able to consent. You fry it up.
I would never be able to find that appetizing. My own leg.
That would be tricky. Yeah, that would be tricky. What if it's your own dick? What if you lose your dick? You saute it up and you put it in a hot dog bun with some mustard.
I would get it cremated and spread the ashes around the various places where I felt that its heart lied.
I love it. So where do you get most shit from? Do you get much shit for being a hunter, and where does it come from?
Other hunters.
Is that right?
So, you'll hear, like, now and then you'll hear from people from the animal rights, but I feel like they think that, you know, I mean, the people in the animal rights movement, I mean, they got in their head that I'm a lost cause, and also there's nothing they can do to me. You know, when animal rights people come at someone, it's someone that they can impact, right? Like, let's say you have a Hollywood celebrity. And that Hollywood celebrity, you know, were to do some thing, and they're like, well, how can we deprive them? Right? What would we do to them to get after them? Well, we'd kind of tarnish their reputation in their community. We'd strip their advertisers, you know, like that's how you punish people. There's nothing they can do to punish me. There's no advertiser that I work with that would. There's no advertiser
like, wow,
that I work
Steve
with.
Steve was mean.
It would be
to
like
an
you.
Animal.
What?
Steve killed
he did
an animal.
What? Yeah, he did what? We're pulling our funding. My publisher, I publish with Penguin Random House, and I publish information about the very thing that. I publish information about the very thing that would piss animal rights people off. So they're well aware because they're editing and publishing the work. There's no like secret. Now, when you get it with like, when, you know, hunters are cannibalistic in that we're all very passionate and we're all very opinionated, and you're likely to, you know, they're all likely to go after someone who's a little different. Meaning, I remember growing up, I grew up in the Midwest, and my family went to a Methodist church. If you'd have asked someone growing up what the main risk was, if you'd asked someone from the Methodist church what a real risk was, what's a real risk? They're not going to say, oh, I got it. It's devil worshipers. They'd be like, Mormons, because it's a little different.
Yeah. The narcissism of small differences.
Yeah, you're like, there's a little, there's something I don't like there. There's a little difference. Yeah. So yeah, that's all the bickering is all like, yeah, I know you like to hunt and everything, but you did this or you don't do that or you, you know, you name it. It's just that. It's not even like shit, because it's like, it's not even like getting shit. It's just like these little squabbles and bickerings. And then somehow you wonder why you're not hearing from the main people that would be really incensed by your behavior. But it's because they can't. I'm just rigged up in such a way where I'm not vulnerable to the attack.
Yeah. Yeah. Also, they know that you're not going to change. It's your whole thing. It's like, yeah, I find this as well politically, right? I mean, you'll find someone, some very agitated social justice activist who spends more time demonizing people on their own side of politics for being insufficiently adherent to the ideology than they do attacking a wild right-wing conservative who would be their natural opponent, but they just conclude that that person is a lost cause, there's no point. They focus on their potential allies instead. So
that's a great point. You see a little like not a wholesale rejection of the orthodoxy, but you got a little piece wrong. Right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's where I get most hate from. Most hate comes for me from the social justice left, because I don't, you know, mouth every single platitude that they want me to or hold every position that I'm supposed to. And I'm like, guys, it's not the conservatives who are attacking me. it's all you, because
they had, you know why? They had hope in you, man. They had faith in you. And
exactly. That's right. I was supposed to be on the same team, and now I'm an irredeemable bigot. So what am I missing? I feel like there's my uncle in New Zealand was a hunter, and I haven't killed anything apart from fish. Mm-hmm. And killed a bird once by accident. What do you get out of it that I don't see?
Man, I'll tell you, I never ever would go to someone who had no desire to go hunting or go fishing, no desire to harm an animal. I never would go and try to talk them out of that perspective, ever. Right? I'm not like, oh, just give it this one chance and you'll see. Right? It's just like, I don't proselytize in that way. Now, what I do like to do, I do like to say, I do like to say, well, when you see that happening, when you encounter the people who do that, I'd love it if you kept this in mind, in considering them and in regarding them. These are some things I'd like you to keep in mind. But I don't say, and you should come tomorrow and I'll take you to go do it. Because I never do that. Now, people who arrive at the fact, who arrive at a feeling that that's something they really want to do, and they're dying to try it, or they need to explore it, or they can't get it out of their head, then I usually extend if it's possible. I'll be like, man, if you're feeling that way about it and you've thought about it, it seems that you thought about it a lot, I would love to have a chance to like take you out and expose you to that and do that with you. But it would be like, because I like you, you know, I'd be like, oh yeah, you're cool. We hit it off. I enjoy your company. I like being around you. You're curious about this. So as a friend thing, I would love to, because I enjoy you, I would love to take you out and show you what this is all about, right? But that's the only time when I feel like actually facilitating someone having a set of experiences, they have to be like, yeah, I want this. I want to do this. I never tell people that they should go against a deep feeling they have because I think they're going to get something out of it, you know?
Well, let me rephrase the question then. What do you get out of hunting that you wouldn't get if you had been born into a situation where you'd never tried it?
Yep, I'll tell you that. Okay, now I'm sorry, I didn't understand your question. I have a great reverence for the natural world, nature, the natural world, wildlife. when I was, I had it ever since I was born. I probably got it because I was raised up by a hunter and a fisherman and someone who loved nature, and they brought me up that way. I've always had that feeling. I feel most at home, most at ease, most engaged, most inspired out on natural landscapes. I'm a hands-on person. Okay. I like to like, it's, I can't, because I love that world and I like being in that world. And I like that it's like an arena of great, it's arena, an arena of great consequence. And I like to be in it, but I like to be in it as an active player. Okay. I like to be active, like a predator on the landscape, a thing on the landscape. And there is no, at this point in my life, and I would have said this when I was 13 years old, at this point in my life, there's no other way that I could ever agree to be alive. If I can't have that and be in that arena and be in that space and be a participant in nature and a participant on the landscape and engage with animals as one to another, like I'm not going to do it. Like I don't care to be alive and go on if I can't have that. There's no way I could give up. It's a huge part of my identity. I identify through work, I identify through my wife and children, and I identify through my relationship with nature. Like those are the things. I've even said to my wife, my program is broken up into three things. It's my work, my family, and the outdoors. And that's it. And there's other little parts, but like that's well, I mean, you're thinking about at any given time, I'm thinking about one of those three things. And I can't back out of it.
Why is hunting so fundamental to the outdoors? I mean, I know people who are, forestry managers who have mm-hmm. been responsible for rehabilitating forests. They are engaged in pest eradication. They might kill a whole lot of animals in traps in order to restabilize the ecosystem. They yep. manage the ecosystem. You know, they feel responsible. They feel custodianship, guardianship over a certain area. And in some ways, they can stand back at the end of it and say, look, that entire, ecosystem over there, or that whole forest, it wouldn't exist without me. But they don't feel the need to pick up a gun and shoot an animal.
It's not, because I could, like there's an old joke, I like two things. I like hunting and fishing. So I could give up hunting, no problem. Not no problem, it'd be tough, but I'd have to fish all the time then. And I'd have to be able to go pick wild mushrooms. But yeah, if I had to pick between hunting and fishing, I'd probably choose fishing. It's like, I need to be out. I'm going to be out engaging with and getting my food. I'm going to be out getting my food on a wild landscape and sharing that food with my family. I can explain it. I can't apologize about it. I'm not articulate and smart enough to really tell you why exactly that has to be that way. It just has to be that way because that's how I, that's just my mental existence.
Yeah.
It's my mental existence.
Do you have a bloodlust?
Yeah, that's an interesting. That's just not a term that we use. It's not a term we use. I have a real desire. Yeah, I have a desire to be successful. But the reason I don't think it's a bloodlust is because if I'm hunting morels, that's a kind of mushroom. If I'm hunting morels, I'm real bummed when we don't get one, and I'm real excited when we get one. And I would rather find one morel. If someone tried to give me morels, I don't even want them. It's like, I mean, I'd take them, but I'm interested in the morels that we found. I like diving for scallops. I like digging clams. They don't bleed.
So it's something about self-sufficiency.
Picking berries, man. I like picking berries a lot. Me and my kids go picking huckleberries in August. If it's a wet summer.
I'm envisaging you dressed like the Sound of Music, like doing little twirls, dressed in a beautiful dress on a berry field atop a mountain. There's a chalet in the background. Sounds great.
Yeah, I'm just out. I'm out. You know, I'm just out there doing it. Like, I don't know, man. So I can imagine, this is going to sound crazy. It's going to sound half arrogant and stuff. But like, if you could somehow bring in a coyote and interview him and be like, hey, you know what, man, here's the deal. I can just give you, you can just stay in this room and I'll give you this vegetable protein concoction and you'll actually be totally fine. You don't need to be running around killing all kinds of birds and small rodents and eating turkey eggs.
You'd be like, what is this Rayco's Wild bullshit?
Is the coyote going to be like, oh, sweet. Right. Or is that coyote going to sit by the door being like, man, I got to get out of here? It'd be like, what, you got a bloodlust? Do you got a bloodlust, Mr. Coyote?
Well, look, the coyote may have a bloodlust because the coyote's not going to be happy getting berries in your Sound of Music landscape or your morel mushrooms. But it sounds to me like yours is different. What you're talking about is this kind of a sense of self-sufficiency, of self-reliance.
Yeah.
Of playing a role, playing a meaningful role in your ability to feed yourself and.
Yeah, and I bring my kids up to, you know, they do all the things that every kid does, but I bring my kids up in the same way because I want them to have like a certain grr, you know? I want them to have like a raw edge to them, and I want them to have like a survival instinct, and I want them to have like a toughness and a self-sufficiency and ability to put up with some discomfort and you know, and like a sharp tooth.
Yeah.
You know, I'll just say it. Like I like them to have that little bit of viciousness somewhere down in them. Mm. It's valuable to me.
Yeah. I mean, I think in terms of parenting, they're going to have that because people have that because humans are mammals and we do have it. And so it's going to come out in some way. And if it doesn't have some healthy way of expressing itself, it's going to come out in some dysfunctional way, like domestic violence or self-harm or Andrew Tate or whatever else, you know, people might pursue to try to scratch that itch. And that's a challenge for people. I mean, that's a challenge for people living in big cities like myself and raising kids and trying to find ways. We've actually just moved for that reason out of a more densely populated part of the city to a slightly more wild part of town where there's a bush walk on our doorstep and you can go down to the river and you can look for oysters and you can hunt for crabs and all that sort of stuff. Yeah.
Well, nice you should go read my book, Outdoor Kids in an Inside World, because I talk about the early years of my kids' lives when they were living in New York and the extremes I went through to begin educating them about nature in that environment.
Fabulous. How'd you get Joe Rogan into hunting? Do you have another 5-10 minutes or?
Yeah. Joe reached out. I've told Joe this before. I didn't know what a podcast was. I work with a woman and we're still buddies. We don't see much of each other, but we're like email buddies, a woman named Helen Cho. And she's always been in television production. And I remember one day Helen Cho saying to me, hey, you're not going to believe this. Joe Rogan wants you to come on his podcast. And I had two questions. I was like, who's Joe Rogan and what's a podcast? But that was a long time ago. It was a long time ago, you know?
Yeah, right.
I just fell in love with him, man. He's just such a genuine, like intellectually curious guy and such a generous person to his friends and things. And I didn't know that at the time, and just had a huge heart, you know, and you can sense that when you're with him. But he was curious about hunting in the same way earlier I was saying that I don't go and tell people that don't want to go hunting that they ought to go hunting. But here's this guy that like really wanted to go and had learned enough about it to know what he was saying when he said he wanted to go. And you know, he's just like, he's he's fascinating. You know, he's very accomplished and interesting. And so why would I not want to have a chance to spend time with him and hang out with him and show someone who's so cool, like a thing that I'm interested in? But it was him. I mean, he wanted to go do it. He would, if I had never come around, I don't think that it would have been too god awful much longer and he would have been hunting someone else. By that point, he was interested, man. You know, he was interested. I didn't tell him some secret thing that changed his mind about shit. You know, he'd grown up fishing and watched a lot of stuff and watched stuff on YouTube. I was the right guy at the right time. You know, I didn't do something to change his mind about it.
And where did you take him and what did you hunt? And what was
we hunted in North Central Montana, which is where I live now. We went home in North Central Montana and went with a buddy of mine who I'm still colleagues and great friends with, Ryan Callahan. And we took Joe and his friend Brian Callen hunting. And then later I hunted with Joe up in Alaska, and I hunted with Joe and one time at my friend's place in California. We hunted down in Nevada one time. We got to hunt in Texas. So we've hunted around a fair bit together over the years. But we've been friendly for quite some time. So every year, every 2 years, we'll get together and go do something.
Has he gotten better?
Oh, yeah, man, because he became an archer, and archery requires a lot of discipline. Like hunting requires a lot of, hunting requires a lot of discipline because there's so many aspects to it about biology, ecology, landscape, geography, on and on and on. But Joe got very obsessed with archery. And to be good at archery, you have to shoot a lot of archery. And so he just got to be like a top tier archer. And I'm not, right? But he really just got into that and fell in love with the discipline required. And so he has got to be where he's just better with a bow than a lot of lifelong bow hunters.
Wow.
But he used to shoot like tournament pool, you know, billiards, you know.
Yeah,
he's not unaccustomed to doing shit with his hands, man. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. I love that guy. I mean, what an adventurous and insightful mind as well. And I'm so glad that he's achieved the success that he has. I mean, he's really, I owe so much of my success to him because I was on his show for the first time 10 years ago. And after the show, he was like, you should just do a podcast, man. Just forget about all the, you know, working for media companies and all that bullshit. Just go and do a podcast. So I was like, okay, mister, you seem to know a lot about things. I'll go and do a podcast. And if I didn't have my 10,000 hours of experience doing another podcast while I was in New York, thanks to Joe, there's no way that this operation would be, you know, providing a living for me and my family. And he's just, there's that story replicated so many times for so many younger people who he has inspired or given, you know, been generous with his time with. You know, he's had me back on the show at times when I've needed to promote something and it's given me a big boost. He's like just such a solid stand-up person that I wish that everybody knew that about him. And, you know, sometimes
that, when I talk about generosity, I mean, besides he's just, you know, I don't know, I guess, you know, like he's like emotionally generous to people, and you hear that when you listen to his show. But he would never like in his mind, he'd never be like, well, I'm not going to have another comic on because I'm trying to launch my own special right now.
No, that's right. Yeah, absolutely. You know what I mean, absolutely. Dude? Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's interesting, isn't it? And we can wrap here because I know you got to run. But yeah. It is interesting, I think, about success that successful people tend to have that attitude of the pie being unlimited, and they're not petty about other people's success. Like, as far as Joe's concerned, the more people doing podcasts, the better. And it this has always been the case, even before he had the biggest podcast in the world. He was like, the more people are doing it, the more excitement there'll be, the more energy there'll be. There's no limit to the number of hours that people can spend listening to podcasts. So it's not like we're all fighting over a finite pie. Let's just all do it. And that's the kind of supportive attitude that I find successful people have, whether that's in comedy or entertainment or writing or whatever else it might be that you're doing. People who
are unsuccessful, it strikes me, are people who try to cling to their own patch of turf and jealously guard it and are always worried about other people stealing their ideas or getting somewhere ahead of them, and like are focused more on where they are relative to their peers than on increasing the size of the pie for everybody. And like Joe is the master of the latter.
Yeah, and picture it just outside of any strategic concern. Just ask yourself which life is more enjoyable to live.
Right. Right.
You know, one of that or one of like one of generosity or one of just jealous guarding of my turf. Outside of strategy.
I'll take jealous guarding of my turf. Thanks, Steve. Steve, great to talk to you. I'm glad we could finally make it work.
Yeah, man, I enjoyed
it a little bit. Thank you for your time.
Next time you come to the good old US of A, man, let me know.